It is Friday, May the 12th. This is VOA's International Edition. It's good to have you with us. Coming up, some analysis of what appears to be, to some, a U.S. political crisis.
I don't think we're in a constitutional crisis. We certainly, however, are in a political crisis. We're certainly in a crisis where public confidence in our system is being undermined.
Also ahead, U.S.-Russian relations going after people smugglers. We'll have some social media trends and the Swiss about to auction $70 million in diamonds. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. President Trump has encountered some resistance for calling ousted Federal Bureau of Investigation Chief James Comey a showboat, an attack that was swiftly contradicted by top U.S. senators and the acting FBI leader, who pledged that an investigation into possible Trump campaign ties to Russia would proceed with vigor. Mr. Trump spoke about it in an interview on NBC News.
I was surprised he said it, but I wasn't angry. There's a big thing going on right now, which is spying. And it's, you can call it anything you want, the unmasking and the spying. And to me, that's the big story right now.
The president went on to say that he had sent a letter to Lindsey Graham, who serves on a Senate committee, looking into whether Russian-backed hackers interfered in last year's U.S. presidential campaign and whether anyone in the Trump campaign had contact with the Russians.
Just sent a letter to Lindsey Graham from one of the most prestigious law firms in the country, a tremendous, highly rated law firm, that I have nothing to do with Russia. I have no investments in Russia, none whatsoever. I don't have property in Russia. A lot of people thought I owned office buildings in Moscow. I don't have property in Russia. And I am I'm in total compliance in every way. Now, I have to tell you, I file documents, hundreds of pages worth of documents with the Federal Elections Bureau. Everybody's seen them. I built a great company, but I'm not involved with Russia. I have had dealings over the years where I sold a house to a very wealthy Russian many years ago. I had the Miss Universe pageant, which I owned for quite a while. I had it in Moscow a long time ago. But other than that, I have nothing to do with Russia.
President Trump appearing on the NBC Nightly News with Lester Holt. President Trump's firing of FBI Director James Comey this week is within his legal authority, but removing him in the middle of an investigation into Russian influence in last year's election and the possibility of collusion with the Trump campaign is raising some concerns. International Edition's Lori London asked legal analyst James Goodnow if any legal problems might exist for Mr. Trump in connection with Comey's dismissal.
Well, I think there are serious concerns here about whether or not Donald Trump's firing of Jim Comey amounted to obstruction of justice. Because the law on this subject says you cannot interfere with, impede, slow, delay, or influence an investigation that is pending if you engage in actions with a motive to obstruct that particular investigation. That really is the concern here. So we have two pieces of this puzzle. One, did Donald Trump fire Jim Comey with the intent of obstructing the Russian collusion investigation? And then question two is there the political will to do anything about that? And that really is what we're seeing unfolding right now, fluidly in front of us.
How would you prove something like that? How would you prove intent?
So in the law, we have two ways of doing that. You can prove intent through direct evidence. That would be Donald Trump testifying as an example that, yeah, that's right, I got rid of Jim Comey to slow down that investigation. Not going to happen. We know that. The second way is through what we call circumstantial evidence. That really means just looking at the context and trying to understand if we can ascertain, if we can glean what was going on in Donald Trump's mind at the time he made that decision, which would, of course, be a challenge even for those closely affiliated with Donald Trump. But it would be even more difficult in the context of any proceedings, which, by the way, would take place through the impeachment process, of understanding what Donald Trump was thinking. So what do we know? If you look at the facts, we can say with certainty that the White House has not done itself any favors right now with the shifting version of events that is changing almost by the hour right now. I think we're up to at least five different stories, because when you look at that, whether you're a juror, whether you're a fact finder, or whether you're a member of the Senate trying to determine whether or not to convict for, say, impeachment, that shift, that change, that morphing of stories goes to the credibility of Donald Trump. And that ultimately is how, if it ever goes that far, which is not possible today politically, that's how you would end up with an obstruction charge, which could lead to impeachment and Donald Trump being removed from office.
What's the likelihood of any of that happening?
As of today, it's low. So let's step back and look at the process. We know that you can't have charges for obstruction of justice because Donald Trump is a sitting president. The law is a little murky on this subject, but the Attorney General's office has looked at it twice, back in the Nixon era and again during the Bill Clinton impeachment process in the 1990s. And the conclusion was that you cannot bring charges against a sitting president. That individual must be removed from office via impeachment first. So then you get to, well, what's required for impeachment? It requires a resolution, an article of impeachment coming from the House with a simple majority. Right now, Republicans control the House. You would need 46 members to break rank to bring those articles of impeachment. If that were to happen, it would move to the Senate. You would then need 14 Senate Republicans to break rank to get the two-thirds majority required to convict under impeachment. It's never happened in the history of our country. So the answer in any situation is it's unlikely that you'll see that. But we do have some Senate Republicans right now who are starting to express concern. Senator Richard Burr from North Carolina, Senator Ben Sasse from Nebraska, John McCain, Jeff Flake. These individuals are expressing reservations, but we don't see enough in terms of numbers of going to that next step of saying, okay, let's move toward impeachment. And that would need to happen before any of this could unfold.
In the letter that President Trump wrote to Mr. Comey terminating his employment, he mentioned that he appreciated that Mr. Comey had three times told him that he was not under investigation. If, in fact, there was a conversation like that, where does that fall as far as the legality of the head of the Federal Bureau of Investigation having a conversation with the president who he potentially could be investigating?
Any conversations like that that took place would certainly be violations of FBI, Department of Justice, and White House policies. There is no federal law on this subject. When we talk about obstruction of justice, there's a United States Code section that deals with it. When it comes to this sort of communication between the FBI and the White House, that is something that is policy driven. So in terms of there being a law to stop it, there is none. In terms of practice, in terms of tradition, it doesn't happen, of course, because these divisions of government were intended to be separate, particularly, of course, when you're talking about the executive branch, the president being investigated by the FBI. There should be a firewall there. So it certainly was inappropriate. It certainly raises ethical concerns, but it doesn't implicate legal concerns.
It certainly would appear we're in a political crisis at the moment. Would you go so far as to call this a constitutional crisis?
The phrase constitutional crisis is being thrown around quite a bit right now, and I would say we are not in a constitutional crisis. Right now, the Constitution outlines the steps that need to take place if, in fact, it's determined that Donald Trump is unfit to serve as president, at least in the estimation of Congress. We have not invoked those constitutional protections yet, so I don't think we're in a constitutional crisis. We certainly, however, are in a political crisis. We're certainly in a crisis where public confidence in our system is being undermined almost by the day. And as we see these sorts of dramatic situations playing out, I think you have voters, constituents, Americans who are concerned. They're concerned for the country. They're concerned for the legitimacy of the systems. And we know Donald Trump is coming in right now with a wrecking ball and making that even worse as he continues to tweet about the subjects, blaming, pointing fingers, and further, I think, confusing and frustrating voters. So we're not at the phase of a constitutional crisis. Our Constitution spells out exactly what is to happen. But again, taking this back to the beginning, whether or not there's the political will for that to happen is an open question.
James Goodnow is a legal analyst. He was speaking with my colleague, Lori London. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on the Voice of America.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is VOA's International Edition. Amid tensions over Russian connections to the U.S. political process, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov held talks with President Trump at the White House. In a news conference at the Russian embassy in Washington afterwards, Mr. Lavrov suggested relations between the U.S. and Russia may have turned a new page. Mr. Trump said he felt good about the talks producing positive results to end the Syrian conflict. While President Trump expressed hope for broader cooperation with Moscow on resolving a number of global conflicts, he called on Russia to rein in the Bashar al-Assad regime in Syria, as well as Iran and its proxies. VOA's Victor Beatty asked University of Denver scholar Jonathan Edelman whether U.S.-Russian cooperation can halt the Syrian conflict.
There is some slight hope that it could be. The Russians have achieved what they wanted to, which was they got their warm water port, they managed to keep Bashar Assad in power, and they've now been seen as, again, a quasi-superpower, certainly in the Middle East. But they're not going to go much further. They can only go so far. And so if you look at what their strategy has been ever since 2008, it's been to get little chunks back, to whether it's Abkhazia or it's southern Ossetia or it's Crimea or it's part of Ukraine. And that's what I think they would settle for here, even though they're reluctant to, which is if they can keep Damascus, if they can keep some of that broad area around it and perhaps Aleppo, I think they'd be willing at the end of the day to trade, because that would still be seen as a great victory, especially if they can control the most important cities in Syria.
Mr. Trump said that he called on Mr. Lavrov and Russia to rein in the Assad regime, Iran, and Iran's proxies. Is that possible?
It might be possible to rein in Syria because the Russians have a powerful role to play. But Iran, you've hit a very important point, which is the Russians are going to have to make several decisions now. One is, are they going to take a realistic American offer to work on ending the terror that's killed over 400,000 Syrians? Or are they going to stay together, especially with Iran, which is very hostile to the United States? But I believe there's some hope here, because clearly there is a deadlock. And clearly we're seeing some progress, and it's mostly recently now been with the Kurds and Raqqa and taking the capital of ISIS. If we can defeat ISIS, that will be a great achievement for the United States. But at some point, this war has got to end. I think we're coming towards that point, but it could be another year or two before the battlefield really reflects that.
U.S. Defense Department has announced that the U.S.-backed Syrian Democratic Forces have seized the strategic town of Tabqa, the Islamic State defenders, along with Syria's largest dam. Tabqa is about 40 kilometers west of Raqqa, the de facto Islamic State capital. In other news, Italian authorities have arrested three different groups on charges of people smuggling. The arrest involved Nigerians, Libyans, and Somalis. Eyewitness accounts say Nigerian smugglers brutally beat migrants repeatedly, even killing some of them and causing severe injuries to others. Reporter Josephine McKenna spoke with VOA's Kim Lewis about the arrest, as well as reaction from an NGO after the Libyan Coast Guard blocked its attempted rescue of hundreds of migrants from a wooden boat.
three different incidents. Two alleged Libyan people smugglers have been arrested by Italian police in the Sicilian city of Catania. Three Nigerians have been arrested in the Sicilian town of Agrigento, accused of trafficking, sexual assault and murder, as well as torture. And in another incident yesterday, Somali people smugglers, alleged people smugglers, were arrested in Bari in southern Italy and other towns across Italy. So we have three separate incidents in relation to people smuggling.
Also, with the arrest of the Nigerians, I understand there were some very horrific details that were relayed. So what were they saying happened?
The three Nigerians believed to have landed on the island of Lampedusa off the coast of Sicily on April 16. And since that time, the Italian police and Italian prosecutors have been listening to witnesses, here taking account of what they have seen, what they have claimed, and we're seeing extraordinary accounts, eyewitness accounts, of what these men are alleged to have done. Now, these three Nigerians alleged to have tortured migrants. One said that his legs had been tied up and he had been repeatedly beaten on the soles of the feet with serious injuries and fractures, but others were much more serious. One said that his brother was violently beaten and died several days later in 2016 because of injuries sustained by one of these migrants. Another one said that gasoline was poured around him and he was set on fire. And another one said that these African men beat at least five migrants and he watched while one of them died immediately and the others were seriously injured and died several days later from the injuries that they sustained in these attacks. So really horrific accounts that the police are using to put together a case against these three Nigerians that have been arrested.
That sounds just really, really horrible as you described. Also, I understand that there's outrage from the NGO Sea Watch after they said the Libyan Coast Guard blocked a rescue attempt.
Yes, as we know, the Italian government has reached an agreement to support the Libyan Coast Guard and try and build up security, try to stop the flow of migrants that we're seeing into Italy and the rest of Europe. And we had an incident where the Libyan Coast Guard intercepted the German NGO Sea Watch as it was trying to rescue 500 migrants packed on a very rickety wooden boat. And the Coast Guard intervened. Sea Watch filmed what happened, and they are claiming that this Coast Guard vessel came way too close to its own ship and nearly caused a collision. And that certainly looks the case on the video that they've put on their website. The Libyan Coast Guard picked up these 500 migrants and took them back to Tripoli, and we're not quite sure what's happened to them since. Now, Sea Watch says this is a very dangerous incident. They are demanding that the EU change this policy immediately, and they are also demanding an independent investigation about what happened in this particular incident.
That is reporter Josephine McKenna speaking with Kim Lewis. She's host of the VOA program Africa News Tonight.
Hi, this is Lori London. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondence reports around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
And it's time now to find out what's trending on social media with International Edition's Andrew Palchevsky.
Trending today, a new cybersecurity executive order from President Trump and fighting words from the founder of Snapchat. First, that executive order signed by President Trump on Thursday. It's pushing government agencies to review their cybersecurity plans and make sure that they have strong cyber practices in place to prevent attacks. It also pushes those agencies to review what they're currently doing and report that back to the Department of Homeland Security so they can assess strengths and weaknesses. Some question about the timing of this executive order, many saying it was signed amid the probe into the Russian hacking in the election. However, Tom Bossert, who is the Trump administration Homeland Security advisor, took to the podium in the briefing room on Thursday and said it was not motivated by Russian hacking, but motivated by a desire to keep the country safe from attacks. Others are saying it comes from a president who encouraged Russia to hack during the presidential election, so there's some question about whether they think this plan will actually work. But many others are saying that any move to increase cybersecurity for the U.S. government is a good one. And those fighting words from Evan Spiegel, the founder of Snapchat, he was on an earnings call for the company, actually the first earnings call since it went public, and he responded to allegations that Facebook was copying Snapchat. We've talked about this on the show previously, how they've incorporated disappearing photos into Instagram, which is owned by Facebook, and how Facebook is using more visual content in their mobile app, things that they call lenses, which are very similar to Snapchat filters. So this is what Evan Spiegel had to say. He said, if you want to be a creative company, you've got to get comfortable with and basically enjoy the fact that people are going to copy your products if you make great stuff. And then he drops this line, which is getting a lot of attention on social media. He says, just because Yahoo has a search box, it doesn't mean they are Google. Now, that's seen as a shot at Facebook. Of course, Yahoo and Google are both search engines, but Google is known more around the world and used much more around the world. It seems as though he's trying to make the comparison between Snapchat and Facebook, saying that Facebook, like Yahoo, is the original company and is big right now, but he thinks Snapchat can be the Google, overtake Yahoo, and grow to be a multi-billion dollar company. Many people saying, though, the comparison falls kind of flat when you think about the fact that Facebook is worth so much more than Snapchat and is only growing and shows no signs of slowing down, while Snapchat is struggling to try to earn money and find relevancy. So we'll see if that comparison holds up, if Spiegel's words are correct, and if they can indeed take on and defeat Facebook.
And many thanks to you, Andrew. International Edition's Andrew Palcheski. You can follow Andrew on Twitter at APAL. I'm on Twitter as well at VOA Norman. And our program, International Edition, can be found at VOA _IE. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
Consumer demand for abalone, also called abalone, has skyrocketed since the 1990s. But the popular hard-shell sea snail, once considered a delicacy so many love to eat, has triggered a growth in illegal fishing. But at the same time, demand has ignited a growth in aquaculture companies, where South Africa leads the way. Peter Britz has studied abalone for 30 years and says most of the sea creatures supplied by farms in South Africa is beating the competition.
And it fetches about double the price of the farmed abalone from Asia.
South Africans farm abalone on land. 10 million liters of seawater are pumped in every hour at this site, and where marketing manager Werner Pike has doubled production every 6 years.
It compares to the best abalone in the world, which is the Japanese abalone.
The global abalone industry has gone from $142 million in 1991 to over $2 billion today. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. You know, next week, some extraordinary jewels are going to be up for bids at Sotheby's and Christie's, the auction houses in Switzerland. VOA's David Byrd tells us one of the stones, a 92-carat flawless diamond, was crafted by the same jewelers who served Louis XV of France.
Looking for something for that special someone? Got a few million dollars just lying around? Then the auction houses Sotheby's and Christie's might have just what you're looking for. As part of its Magnificent Jewels and Noble Jewels auction, Sotheby's is offering a pair of pear-shaped diamond earrings known as Apollo and Artemis. Apollo is a fancy vivid blue 14.54-carat internally flawless Type 2B diamond. Artemis is a fancy intense pink 16-carat VVS2 Type 2A diamond. Both hang from smaller white diamonds as a set of earrings, but because they are extraordinary stones, they are also being offered separately. David Bennett is the worldwide chairman of Sotheby's International Jewelry Division.
It's the first time that a pair of earrings of this value have ever appeared at auction. They're certainly the most valuable recorded. And they're composed of two diamonds that are really sensational.
Bennett says that each stone is a treasure alone, but it will take quite a hefty bid to get the two of them.
looked at separately, each of these stones is extraordinary and a perfect example of their category. Together, they are unprecedented and absolutely outstanding. We've estimated, combined estimate, is $50 to $70 million.
If pink and blue diamonds are not your style, perhaps you could bid on La Légende, a 92-carat, D-color, flawless, heart-shaped diamond mounted on a pearl necklace. The stone is being offered May 17th at Christie's in Geneva with an estimated value of $14 to $20 million. Rahul Kadakia is the international head of jewelry at Christie's, and he says this stone has a unique history.
The legend, the diamond, was cut, polished, and designed in a necklace by famed Parisian jeweler Baumer and Bezange, who is an 18th-century jewelry house that used to be jewelers for the court of Louis XV.
At the same auction, a ring featuring a 15-carat Burmese pigeon blood ruby mounted in an oval of diamonds is up for bids. Jean-Marc Lunel is a jewelry specialist at Christie's.
This is a fabulous 15-carat pigeon blood Burmese ruby, or 15 and 300 carats to be precise, estimated at $10 to $15 million, which means that the estimate, with fees included, is now $800,000 per carat. We hope to exceed this price, which would be a world record for this kind of ruby.
The Christie's sale also features pieces formerly owned by Doris Duke and Elizabeth Taylor, signed pieces from Bulgari and Cartier, as well as cashmere sapphires and Colombian emeralds. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
You know, Dave and I talked about pooling our money and maybe buying a billionth of one of those stones. Huh? What do you think, we could afford it? Listen, everybody, thanks for tuning in to The Voice of America. This is International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. The latest world news is straight ahead. I hope you'll stay tuned for that. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Greg Burns, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Vice President Mike Pence recently marked the 69th anniversary of Israel's independence. On the fifth day in the month of Iyar in the Hebrew calendar in 1948, he noted, the State of Israel was reborn. Since the moment of their independence, said Vice President Pence, the Israeli people have awed the world with their strength of will and their strength of character. They've turned the desert into a garden, scarcity into plenty. And people of Israel have turned hope into a future of security and prosperity. And under President Donald Trump, said Mr. Pence, the world will know this. America stands with Israel because her cause is our cause, her values are our values, and her fight is our fight. President Trump has committed to resolving the Israeli and Palestinian conflict. And while there will undoubtedly have to be compromises, said Vice President Pence, you can rest assured President Donald Trump will never compromise the safety and security of the Jewish state of Israel. Not now, not ever. President Trump is determined to keep his promise to defeat the terrorist threat. ISIS is on the run, said Mr. Pence, and we will hunt down and destroy ISIS and terrorist organizations at their source so they no longer threaten the United States or its allies. The United States has put Iran on notice. America will no longer tolerate Iran's efforts to destabilize the region and jeopardize Israel's security. Under President Donald Trump, the United States of America will not allow Iran to develop a nuclear weapon, said Vice President Pence. It was faith that led the Jewish people to return to their ancient homeland, said Mr. Pence. It was hope that spurred them to strive with all their strength for a brighter future. Israel is an eternal testament to the undying fortitude of the Jewish people, said Vice President Pence, to the unfathomable power of human freedom, and to the unending faithfulness of God.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.